What is going on, everyone? This is Rich Killen, and this is the Welcome to Hope podcast. Today, we are joined with the one and only Sam Lample.
Hey, Rich. Hey, everybody.
And we are glad to have him back. For those of you that listened at the beginning of our podcast journey, he was with us on the first couple of podcasts. And we were hoping at the time to do this a lot more frequently, but life kind of interfered, as it tends to do from time to time.
Yeah, I got pretty sick for a while, guys. Just kind of set me back, but I'm feeling much better now and super excited about being back on the podcast on a regular basis.
Yeah, and we're happy to have you. And the last time I think we had you on here, we were talking about OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah.
Which we kind of started with because that is a specialty that we both have. But today I wanted to talk about a specialty that's probably your main specialty. I don't have anywhere near as much experience in it as you do, but that would be eating disorders. So I guess, first of all, how did you get started in the eating disorder world?
So I started in eating disorder treatment in April of 2001. At the time, I was finishing up my degree in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and the first real job offer I got was at a residential treatment center for eating disorders in Wickenburg, Arizona, called Remuda Ranch. So basically, the only reason I got started in eating disorders is because they offered me the job.
Well, in Remuda Ranch, at least at the time, if it isn't still, it was one of the kind of premier residential facilities, correct?
Yeah, you can make an argument that it was either the top one or two residential eating disorder treatment centers in the country, if not the world at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not a bad place to get your feet wet.
No, it was actually the perfect introduction into the world of mental health and eating disorder treatment, and really high-end, high clinical value eating disorder treatment. I had a tremendous amount of training there from seasoned clinicians and psychiatrists and you name it. It was incredible.
So that was, about 22, almost 22 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, it's gone by really fast.
And so you've been working in the eating disorder, with the eating disorder population for, in various capacities since then.
Yeah. So, you know, while I was at Remuda, I was part of the adolescent program for the most part, ran the children's program for about a year. That was ages 8 to 13. And then I developed and ran the only residential treatment center for eating disorders for boys exclusively. That lasted for about a year before that was closed. Since then, I've developed intensive outpatient eating disorder programs for different treatment centers in the Valley. Developed a couple of partial hospitalization programs for eating disorders as well. I've done some consultation for residential eating disorder treatment centers in different parts of the country.
Wow.
And in the process now at LifeTree of building yet another eating disorder IOP for adults, for the time being.
And you've done several speaking engagements as well on the topic of eating disorders, correct?
Oh, yeah. I've probably spoken professionally 30, 40 times, done a couple television interviews, written a couple articles, and now looking forward to getting into this podcasting stuff with you.
Yeah.
Exciting.
So I know, like I said earlier, I don't have anywhere near the experience that you do with eating disorders. In fact, all my experience has come because of you.
Sorry about that.
And helping out periodically in some of the IOP programs. But I know when I was fresh in this field in grad school, I had a lot of misconceptions about what exactly an eating disorder was. And I think that there's a lot of those out there. And so I was hoping we could spend some time maybe talking about not only what exactly is an eating disorder, but also kind of maybe dispelling some of those myths that maybe you've kind of come across over the years.
Yeah, let's tackle some of that. The best definition of an eating disorder that I've ever heard is that the idea that eating disorders are at their core brain-based issues with a behavioral presentation around food, body, and exercise. And what they're not, right? You know, you're talking about misconceptions or myths or inaccurate kind of descriptions of eating disorders that I've run into. I think one of the first things, or one of the common misconceptions, that eating disorders are a fad.
Right.
And that eventually, right, you know, they'll lose their popularity in mainstream culture and they'll just go away.
Right.
And unfortunately, we now have 4 or 5 decades worth of information that said that that's not the case. And if you really look into the history, like you can find scholarly articles on eating disorders that go all the way back to the 1800s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then if you even further back, if you read a lot of Greek and Roman history, particularly Romans, had some very unhealthy behaviors around food that we would associate more with like binge eating disorder or bulimia these days.
Right.
So history says eating disorders are not a fad. And so they're here to stay. There's no doubt about that. I think another misconception is the idea that eating disorders are a choice, and that if I felt like it, I could just stop doing the behaviors and it would just be extremely easy. It would require no effort at all. And, you know, you'll hear that represented by phrases like, oh, look, can't you just like eat a sandwich, you know?
Right.
Or, you know, do me a favor and have a cookie every once in a while or something to that effect. But if it was easy to stop, then people would stop it by themselves. The reality is they cannot. Because, as we mentioned, it is a brain-based issue. This is not about willpower. It's not about morality. These are other misconceptions that only weak-minded people struggle with eating disorders or addictions, for that matter.
Right.
Or it's people that just have questionable integrity. And if they were more morally sound or spiritually upright, you know, in some way, shape, or form, they would be able to battle this particular illness. You know, some other misconceptions, the idea that if I ignore it, it will go away.
Right.
Or if I am not, you know, more nice and more kind and more loving to the individual in my life who has an eating disorder, then that will convince them to get better. And I can tell you that that strategy does not work either. You know, one of the pitfalls in treating eating disorders is that there's not a nationally or internationally accepted principle on how to do it. Now, we're getting closer to that, in my opinion.
In terms of how to treat it?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, so there's no gold standard protocol and say, follow this, 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 and then, you know, you can expect that 90% of the time folks are going to get better. It just doesn't work like that with eating disorders. Although I think there is one factor that does largely predict success when it comes to eating disorders, and that's actually length of stay.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, you know, generally, and I believe there's research out there to back this up, you know, when you have length of stay that's greater than 90 days, I think you can expect that the gains that were made in treatment, perhaps weight gain,
right,
but also gains made in learning new behaviors, breaking behavioral patterns, can be sustained over time with appropriate follow-up. What I see and have seen, you know, more and more over the past, you know, 2 decades since I've been involved in eating disorder treatment is the tendency for insurance companies to drive shorter lengths of stay,
right,
which is almost a total guarantee of relapse. And then, and I think, so I'm convinced that shorter length of stay, it undermines the treatment process and is not predictive of positive outcome.
Now, when you're talking about length of stay, are you talking about like in an outpatient program, in an intensive outpatient program, residential?
Yes, all of them.
Okay.
All of them. And I do believe that 90 day is an important number across the board, whether it's at a residential treatment center, at an intensive outpatient program, at partial hospitalization or day treatment, which I think mm-hmm. is a better descriptor of, for what partial hospitalization is, or even just outpatient therapy. You expect that that's going to take a long time. You know, in addition to that, we know that it doesn't take one provider to treat an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. It usually takes a team of providers, including, you know, but not limited to a quality therapist, dietitian who knows eating disorders, a psychiatrist who knows eating disorders, mm-hmm. sometimes a separate family therapist, a support group, you know, and the list goes on and on.
Right.
So there's, I always tell the patients that I work with, you know, there are no lone rangers when it comes to recovery from eating disorders. I've never known someone who was able to do that by themselves.
With maybe just them and a therapist.
Okay,
you need, exactly. You need a team of therapists.
You need a team. And you need a support team outside of therapy, just as important as you do a good treatment team.
Right.
Absolutely.
Which is where that family therapy piece comes into play, because a lot of times that support team is family.
Yes. Family therapy, support group. Bottom line is, you know, if a patient is just like, well, it's just me, I'm the only one that knows about my eating disorder, you know, right off the bat, I'm like, that's not going to cut it.
Right.
You know, just, again, doesn't work that way.
Yeah. As I began to learn more about eating disorders, the one thing that I found was how much more complex it was
yep.
than what I originally thought, because I thought it was more along the lines of it's a choice, like just eat something,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And in my experience, it's so much more complex than that. Mm. And I don't know, are they able to identify like how eating disorders develop? I know in some things, like we talked about OCD previously, there's still, the research is still out on mm-hmm. exactly how something like that develops, but do they have sort of the etiology of how yeah. eating disorders kind of come about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of studies on genetic predisposition, heritability, epigenetics. For instance, there's a set of symptoms that are referred to as prodromal symptoms. There's four of them.
Okay.
And these behaviors can show up as early as age 3 or 4.
Wow.
And are highly predictive of eating disorder development. They include, you know, a child who struggles with change, a child who has perfectionistic behavioral tendencies early on that would be very similar to OCD. The child would exhibit an obsessive thought style. It's very difficult to get them off of a certain thought process or a certain subject matter. And lastly, they don't enjoy food the way that a typical child would enjoy food. Technical term for this is anhedonic eating, or
okay.
eating without pleasure.
Okay.
And so, and like I said, you can spot this behavior in kids as young as 3 or 4. I was just referencing teaching on this in our intensive outpatient eating disorder program here at LifeTree this week. And one of our patients very much identified each one of those in herself by age 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is there a way to catch something like this early?
Yeah, only if we're preparing folks through education, you know, and we got a lot of work to do.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because we get more information, not education, but information mm-hmm. about dieting and beauty products.
Right.
Then we get about how to identify someone who's at high risk for an eating disorder sure. at an early age.
Sure.
Like, you're much more likely to see an 8-year-old on a diet plan than an 8-year-old being introduced to the idea of these are some red flags or for developing eating disorder behavior. You want to be careful with that, though, right? Because you don't want to do preventive work mm-hmm. and then at the same time teach someone how to have an eating disorder. Right. You know, this right. happens in middle schools all the time. You know, so it'll be nutrition awareness week or something like that. And what ends up happening is someone is going to go through a list of behaviors associated with bulimia or binge eating disorder or anorexia. But while they're doing it, they're actually teaching the child how to have the illness,
right,
or be better at it. I see that all the time, you know, when tracing eating disorder onset, I find out that, you know, I say, well, when did all this start for you? And it's routinely a child would be like, yeah, it was seventh grade health class.
Right.
You know, and I'd been thinking about it. And then I got a couple more ideas. And the next thing you know, here I go.
Right. Well, and I think a lot of times, I mean, it's been a while since I've been in, you know, seventh, eighth grade health class. But I feel like a lot of times those classes talk about calories are bad.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the message, which yeah. it's easy to see how that can develop into this disordered thinking around food.
Oh, for sure. It takes such a complex situation and makes it a black and white thing. I mean, nutrition, complex.
Right.
Overall health, complex. Mental health, complex. Even with something as simple, you know, I'm making air quotes, everybody, something that's supposed to be as simple as appetite, it's not simple because we have multiple systems in the brain that are designed to manage appetite. They all work in harmony with each other. You right. know, there's a homeostatic system. There's a hedonic system. There's a risk reward system. There's particular enzymes in the stomach that communicate with the brain about fullness and hunger. That's not a simple thing. You know, mm-hmm. it's not just eat a sandwich.
Right.
You know, it's much bigger than that. And we haven't even got to the real sort of activating stuff of eating disorders, which isn't so much the physical. I mean, here's another myth, right? Is like only fat people develop eating disorders,
right?
You know, in a reaction to losing weight. I mean, but when you look at statistically, you look at people with anorexia, the vast majority of them were never overweight in females.
Yeah. Right.
Now, if you look at it in males, it's a different story. If males developing anorexia, about 25%, maybe a little bit more of the time, they were actually significantly overweight. And because of it, highly bullied and severely teased. But that's just not the case in girls.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think the real issue, again, if you look at studies, you could say that eating disorders are an anxiety disorder with an emphasis on food, body, appearance,
mm-hmm.
activity, things of this nature. Because, you know, there are some meta-analyses that were done a while ago.
Right.
but they looked at it, but it's really good reliability and validity because of the sample size that reflect that in 60% of the cases of an eating disorder, a person had a pre-existing anxiety disorder. Now, whether they knew about it or not, whether it was diagnosed or not, is a different story, but it was there.
Right.
And then when you talk about treatment, you find that another 10% of individuals with eating disorders are found to have anxiety diagnoses as well. So that's roughly 70% of people with eating disorders have anxiety, most likely pre-eating disorder.
Gotcha.
Another thing is trauma.
Yeah.
You know, depending upon how you define trauma, how loosely versus how structured you are, detailed with your trauma definition, you can find anywhere from 60 to 90% of individuals with eating disorders have experienced some form of trauma in their lives. That's a massive number.
Right. Yeah.
But I always tell people, you know, I know right off the bat, if I meet you and you're already diagnosed with an eating disorder, you've most likely experienced a tremendous amount of emotional pain already in life. And then the recovery from eating disorders, then probably the hardest thing that a person has ever gone to do.
Yeah. Wow. So in your 2 decades plus of experience in eating disorders, and you said there's no kind of gold standard for the treatment, but in your opinion, what's the best way to go about treating something as complex as an eating disorder?
Well, I've been on a bit of a journey for these 20 years. Very beginning, I thought a Rogerian client-centered, person-centered style of just being warm and empathic was going to do it, and that was not effective. I then switched more to a traditional CBT approach for a while, trying to do a lot of cognitive restructuring, but also found that that really was not working because of the obsessive thought style of people who have eating disorders. So trying to get them to be flexible with their thoughts by changing their thoughts didn't work either, in my opinion. I shifted then to dialectical behavior therapy and had some success there. The skills modules, particularly around distress tolerance, well, all four of them actually are very effective when it comes to eating disorders, but it was also missing something. And what I think it was missing was that DBT really didn't get to the, it didn't answer the question why for me. So, and here's what I mean by that is people with eating disorders stay in the eating disorder because they perceive that it works for them. There's a payoff. They get something out of it. Most of them get multiple things out of it. That's why they're willing to put up with it. At some point you get some education, you get a perspective and you realize, well, wow, this really kind of costs me more than it gives me, but it's still the perceived benefit that keeps the person stuck in the process. So you have to offer them something bigger than the illness. And until I ran into acceptance and commitment therapy, or what's known as ACT, I didn't have anything bigger to offer them. What ACT offers is the possibility of living a value-driven life and a life that has purpose and meaning, a life that could be enjoyed, life that it could be consistent with how that person wants to see themselves. And that has proven pretty powerful. It's not perfect. It doesn't affect everybody the same way. But when you can help a person understand that they've been living a value set that's dictated by a mental illness like an eating disorder, a lot of people don't like that realization, you know, and then they're interested in, well, what is a healthy boundaries value set? What does that look like? How do I create that? And then what would it look like to behave in service with those values on a daily basis? That's when they start to find that the illness, the eating disorder, is actually interfering with their lives as opposed to enhancing their lives. And then we start to get some leverage. You know, and I'm going to say a slightly different way. Most of the values that people will attest to having are more obsessional and come out of the illness process. Because they're not freely chosen. They're created out of fear and anxiety. And I would argue that those are not the most valid values. Values need to be freely chosen. Not based in fear. And, you know, eating disorders, as I pointed out, all about fear and anxiety, even before the development of the illness. So it's always good to remind a person that they have an eating disorder, but they are not their eating disorder. They are not an eating disorder. You know,
their identity sometimes is wrapped up in that one aspect.
You know, eating disorders are, again, tough to treat because they're what's considered egocentric, which means that the person kind of sees the illness as something that is very similar or complementary to their identity. Now, the question is, you know, how did that happen, or when did that happen? Like, did it start out that way or did it become that way? And I would say it's going to vary in certain situations. But the better question is, can we separate that person's identity from the eating disorder? And the answer is yes. We need to do that early on, actually, if we're going to be effective in the treatment of these illnesses.
So when you're working with a patient with an eating disorder, such as in our IOPs or something like that, there's a heavy DBT component, heavy ACT component. Anything else that you would typically sprinkle in there?
We do a lot of process groups. Individual therapy is important. Family therapy can be necessary depending upon the age of the person and their willingness to engage in family therapy. But a lot of people are resistant to that because they believe mistakenly that it's their issue, that it doesn't affect anybody else. And that's just not the case. But I think the majority of the work is done actually in the process groups. And, you know, what we're focusing on there is emotional identification, expression, regulation, due to some factors that fuel eating disorders that have not really been addressed, or skills around identifying and feeling their feels, as people say. Mm-hmm. You got to feel your feels in order to get better. So the tendency is, I think, not just with eating disorders, but most emotional issues, mental health issues, people want to go around their hard feelings,
right?
Which doesn't allow for any resolution at all.
Sure.
Right. That's just an avoidance tactic.
Right. Yeah.
We use our process groups as a way to take people through their feelings in a safe environment with a tremendous amount of immediate support, feedback, and validation. Mm. And it really is amazing to hear some of the feedback from the group members in our intensive outpatient program as of late, and regarding how safe the group feels.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how often they find themselves sharing things that they had never shared with anyone before, and then being very surprised by their ability to do that, again, referencing how safe it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and I don't necessarily mean this as a shout out to our own IOP programs here, but I guess that is also part of it. If we're being honest, you know, I think there's a lot of programs out there, and you would know this better than me, that are very cookie cutter, that have, it's almost so structured that, like you know what's going to happen every day, which there's some value in that, but with something so complex, I feel like there needs to be some flexibility. And I think our program, the way that you sort of conceptualize all this and run these programs, there's a lot of flexibility there to provide what the individual needs, not trying to fit the individual to the program, but trying to fit the program to the individual.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oftentimes this is referred to as individualized care. I actually like to call it personalized care.
Yeah, I like that.
Because it reflects the emphasis on the unique needs of the person, and that person is actual a person as opposed to a patient number.
Sure.
Which is why we don't have patient numbers. So, you know, one of the primary principles of ACT is the development of psychological flexibility as an indicator of mental health. So we actually set up our scheduling to promote psychological flexibility. So we have an overall schedule that we follow loosely based on where our patients are on any given day.
Sure.
So we might set out expecting to do A, B, and C in the first hour, but end up finding ourselves in a completely different place, in which case we're going to stay in the moment and address the issue that has presented itself, which is a great way to practice mindfulness and, you know, being present.
Sure.
So the program runs as an, you know, basically an organic system to promote psychological flexibility. I had a couple of years ago, I had someone ask me, you know, who was in our OCD IOP. And they said, you know, shouldn't I have a weekly master schedule? And my response was no, you know, because then you know in your rigid structure exactly what to prepare for. We're trying to teach you how to deal with uncertainty.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of exposure principles built into what we do. It is very much other compared to other programs. And it's not that other programs' concepts don't work. I think all programs have some value to them.
Right.
We just do things a little different.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is great. So I guess we can sort of end on this. What would you say to somebody out there that is considering treatment for an eating disorder, or maybe a family member or loved one of someone who maybe has an eating disorder?
Yeah.
They're still kind of contemplating the next steps or not sure where to go. What would you say to that person?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is don't wait and don't pretend that if you give it a little time, it'll go away. You know, because if you're already noticing it, it is a problem. And what I mean by that, if it's affecting a person's health, if it affects their ability to live their lives, if it's causing them to become distant from you,
right?
All you can see that it's already taken its toll. The longer we wait, the more entrenched the illness comes, the more the person identifies with the illness, as we were talking about before, and that just makes treatment all the more difficult. So what I would say is if you're questioning, call us. Let's get an assessment done. If you would rather meet with a dietitian first, we can make that happen. But yeah, the bottom line is don't wait.
Yeah.
Don't wait. That's the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. Well, Sam, it was great having you on. I'm glad we could have this conversation. I'm sure at some point we will probably kind of circle back to this.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot more we can go into when it comes to eating disorders.
Absolutely. We just scratched the surface. And, you know, it's great to be back on the podcast. I know you've done a phenomenal job while I've been out. But my intention is to be a consistent part because this is a lot of fun. love spending time with Rich and hopefully having an audience with whoever's going to listen to this. So make sure you give us your feedback and, you know, look us up on our website, lifetreecounselingaz.com.
Yeah. And if there's any additional topics that you are interested in, feel free to let us know that, on our social media pages on Instagram and Facebook. And we'd be happy to dive into that because we want this to be helpful for all of you.
Yeah.
Not just us talking to each other, but we want this to be beneficial, and that's the reason we're doing this. So as always, if you know anybody that might be, of interest of this conversation on eating disorders today, please feel free to share, and we'll be back with some more great episodes coming up here in the near future.
Bye everybody. See you next time.
The content in this program is not intended to be a substitute for professional counseling, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your mental health professional or other qualified mental health provider with any questions you may have. Never disregard professional advice or delay seeking counseling because of something you have heard on this podcast. If you or someone you know is in need of counseling in the state of Arizona, feel free to call us at 602-488-6104. If you are in crisis or think you may have an emergency, please call 911 immediately. If you are in Maricopa County, Arizona, and are in a behavioral health crisis, you can call the crisis hotline at 1-800-631-1314. If you are outside of Maricopa County, you can call your local crisis hotline or simply dial 988 for the National Suicide Hotline. If you are outside of the United States, please call your local emergency number immediately.